This is The Guardian.
Beim Quiz Wer weiß denn sowas? Erwartet dich der Gipfel des unglaublichen Wissens. Kennst du die richtige Antwort? 2018 wurde ein Wilderer im US-Bundesstaat Missouri dazu verurteilt, während seiner einjährigen Gefängnisstrafe A. rein vegetarisch zu leben, B. einmal im Monat den Film Bambi anzusehen oder C. ein Kinderlexikon über Tiere auswendig zu lernen. Die richtige Antwort ist B. einmal im Monat den Film Bambi anzusehen. Wer weiß denn sowas? Immer montags bis freitags um 18 Uhr im Ersten.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, one of the games of the season at St James's Park, a 90s Newcastle-Liverpool throwback. Fabian Schär somehow squeezing home a last-minute equaliser after Mo Salah had just done some Mo Salahing twice. Chelsea a second, how about some taking them seriously title challengers chat question mark after an unsurprising hammering of Southampton. Cucurella's hair just too tempting for Jack Stevens. Speaking of unsurprising, there's Arsenal being good at set pieces and Spurs being bad at, well, football. Pep gets back on the horse and back down the running order at home to Forest. Everton score four goals in a game. That's four more than they scored last month. So there's pressure on Gary O'Neill and pressure on Julen Lopetegui as West Ham do virtually nothing at Rude's Leicester. And there are good wins for Fulham, Villa and Palace. After that, we'll discuss the fallout of the Rainbow Laces controversy. There's a brilliant FA Cup third round draw and a Club World Cup draw too. Hashtag take it to the world, whatever it is. This is the Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, welcome.
Morning, mate.
Hello, Troy Townsend.
Hi, Max.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
You might notice there was no plus your questions during the intro. That's because the Guardian journalists were on strike on Wednesday and Thursday, so we didn't put anything out on social media. We didn't do a pod on Wednesday or Thursday, and we obviously don't often do a pod on a Friday, but we had put this Friday in the diary before the strike action was called, because of the Thursday night games. If you're wondering why we are doing a pod at all today, let's start at St James's Park. Newcastle 3, Liverpool 3. It's an open goal question, Barry, but what a brilliant game this was.
Yeah, probably the best of the season so far. A real humdinger from two sides who've provided us with plenty of them in the past. And it was sort of a hark back to the 90s, wasn't it, when they were drumming up thriller after thriller, it seemed, like Michael Jackson. This game, it had pretty much everything. I think both teams will feel they probably should have won. I think a point's a pretty good result for both of them. There were lots of contentious decisions, good goals, near misses. Just a real white-knuckle ride. I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah, Newcastle, I don't know what to make of them this season. We've seen the very worst of them and the very best of them and somewhere in between in their last three games. And, you know, obviously this is a good result for Arsenal and Chelsea and Man City. But while Liverpool, they pretty much threw it away with that Queevin Kelleher mistake right at the death. I think a point at St James's Park is okay.
Yeah, I mean, given where they are in the league and their lead, I think you're probably right. Troy, I'm trying to work out how Fabian Schär squeezed that in. I mean, like 999 times out of 1,000, he is not scoring that goal, however big a mistake it was from Keller.
I think Mo Salah asked him the question at the end of the game as well, like, how did you squeeze that in? How did you get that in? Listen, it's a great finish. It's, you know, it's what they call not even a poacher's goal, is it? Because he's got no right on putting it in from there. And it seemed to go in slow motion as well. But listen, he tracked the run of the ball, which Keller didn't. He made his dive to, you know, his effort to try and squeeze it in. And he did it. it was an accomplished finish by a centre-half. I think he'll be very pleased because he'll probably be very disappointed that Mo Salah got himself on the score sheet twice. Listen, Mo Salah was great in both the goals. Trent involved in both the goals, but they'll probably be disappointed there. But I think, like Barry said, it's only what Newcastle deserve. They put a lot of effort into the game. And remember, they're taking on a Liverpool side that is flying, a Liverpool side that didn't really wake up in the first half, but definitely turned the screw in the second half. And yeah, at one point you think 3-2 that Liverpool are gonna win it, but well done, Cher.
Yeah, you did call him Keller, and it's just worth pointing out that it wasn't Casey Keller that Arne Slot had drafted in to not catch that cross. But we've all said, look, Keller has had a brilliant season for Liverpool so far, and so we don't need to hammer him too much. Newcastle, Jordan, really took it to Liverpool, which, given their form, I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, Barry mentioned that they're a bit of an odd team. They've had a bit of an odd season in that they've taken points from Manchester City, Liverpool and Arsenal, my lot, this season. Yet they got really comfortably beaten, I thought, at home to West Ham the other day. And they've dropped some other really, what I think they would describe as cheap points this season. I had Newcastle finishing in the top five this season. I look at their squad when everybody's fit, and that's an important caveat to add. And I like their squad. They've got a really balanced squad that on paper, and I accept football's not played on paper, should do a lot better than they are currently doing. They've got some power in midfield. They've got some guile in midfield. They've got, for me, the second best striker in the league up top. Defensively, I think they're good without being necessarily great. So their season, for me, was almost encapsulated in this 1-3-3 game. But just quickly on Liverpool as well, I thought that the point they've got, they were disappointed because of the way it happened in the end. But there will be certain games you'll tick off and think to yourself, you know what, St James's Park away, if we can get a point there, it's not on paper, again, the worst point that you can take. It feels bad at the time, of course, because of how it happens. And I think the Isak goal, going back to Newcastle, might be the best.
Unbelievable.
That might be my favourite goal of the season so far this season. I love that goal. I love him.
He's a tremendous player. Baz, Mo Salah, I have no questions. I don't know what to ask. Not even a, he's great, isn't he? I just don't know what to ask now. He didn't have a brilliant first hour, really. And then he just totally turned it on.
Yeah, totally turned it on. He scored two, created one, hit the angle of the bar and the post with a shot. And I have a certain level of agreement with people who think it would be rash to put a blank contract in front of him and let him and his agent add the number. But because we have seen in the past how quickly aging players, how quickly their legs can go and they lose their mojo. But on current form, there's no one better than him in the Premier League, really. The way he seemed to just come alive in this game. Normally, if you're having a bad game, it stays bad. But he, as you say, had a very quiet hour and then was just outstanding for the final 30 minutes. So it's a nice pickle for Liverpool to be in, wondering, you know, whether or not to give him the deal he wants.
Jordan had his hand up before Troy.
Jordan, I didn't know that.
Wait your turn, Townsend.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd just like to point out for the benefit of listeners that Max is wearing his television shirt and seems to have turned into Fiona Bruce on Question Time. Yeah.
Man in the white T-shirt.
Where's the microphone? I just to add to Barry's point, just briefly, what Salah's doing, he's figuratively kind of grabbing the Liverpool board by the collar and pushing him up against the wall and basically saying, give me my money, pay me my money. His performances have been so good in recent weeks. I agree with Barry. This whole paying what he wants stuff, I just think is really weird. It's a really weird take to kind of, you don't just say to someone, you know, name your price. That's not how business works. But he is making it very, very hard for Liverpool to almost not give him what he wants by the way that he's performing.
Troy?
My points are irrelevant now, so let's move on, Max.
Why are they irrelevant? Man in the roll neck. Man in the roll neck in the middle of the Zoom call.
No, I was going to talk about a little bit more about his performance. Remember, he flashed that shot against the bar as well. I just think that with Salah, and this is why I think he was getting a little bit disappointed with Jurgen Klopp last year, because he is never out of a game, no matter what his performance may be, no matter what people think sometimes or management think sometimes that he's not involved, we'll get someone else on. he proved with the way that he switched it on the other night, and he proved that you can never keep this guy quiet. And as well as Newcastle had done up to that point, I think Barry mentioned about the 60th odd minute, for the next 29 minutes or whatever else, he was just electric. And you can't buy that. So I understand the narrative around the contract, but I can't believe a football club would leave someone like Mo Salah, a Virgil van Dijk, down to this moment in time. Because remember, come January, there'll be those that are coming in and offering him some kind of silly money. I believe he does want to stay, but, you know, sometimes your heads, as we know, can be turned. But I hope we keep him in the Premier League, because we're losing too many good talents anyway. And Mo Salah is up there right about now with just the best.
A couple of contentious moments, Baz. I think Newcastle wanted a penalty. I wasn't quite sure. It was one of those, if it's given, it's going to stay given if it isn't. But I did think Van Dijk knew exactly. He did it brilliantly, but I thought he knew exactly what he was doing when he took Anthony Gordon out. And, like, he's so much bigger than Anthony Gordon. It's like, it just sort of felt a little bit rude.
Yeah, that should undeniably have been a penalty for Newcastle, which, if scored, would have put them 2-0 up. Whether or not it was a red card, I think no. And then there was another one when Jarrod Kwanzaa put his leg across Alexander Isak. He did bring him down, but I think crucially he got a toe to the ball before Kwanzaa went over his leg. So I wouldn't have given a penalty for that one. And then there was a suggestion Liverpool might have had a penalty for a late Dan Byrne handball when a McAllister shot hit his hand. But his arm was tucked in by his chest, so that would have been very harsh. I think it would have been given in a Champions League game, but not in the Premier League, the greatest league in the world.
Absolutely. Well, well done all of them for providing all that entertainment. It was a brilliant game. Let's do Chelsea, who are up to second. They hammered Southampton 5-1, which, Jordan, isn't a surprise, is it? But, you know, Maresco changed it up. Felix played and Cuckoo played. Toyson played. They brought in a goalkeeper who I hadn't heard of, despite probably watching him about 20 times for Villarreal. Are they title challengers, is my question.
So I'm glad you've asked that, because this is really irking me, right? This whole Chelsea are in the title race, because I think we have to separate the questions, are Chelsea in the title race, from should we take Chelsea serious as potential Premier League winners? Because if the question is, are they in the title race? Well, technically, yeah. I look at it like an Olympic 100-meter final race. I've got Usain Bolt to my right. I've got Carl Lewis to my left. I'm in the race. I ain't winning that race. I'm not winning that. There's no way I'm winning that race, but I'm in the race.
You might have Carl Lewis now. I mean, Carl Lewis probably must be 70-odd, mustn't he?
Well, you'd be surprised. I'm pretty slow, Max. But I hear people say, yeah, they're in the race because they're second. And I'm like, but if we replace Chelsea with Ipswich, we would never take Ipswich seriously as title contenders. So,
but they're not second. Ipswich aren't. Second.
No, but the point I'm making is that people make that argument because Chelsea are currently second. And I'm saying just because you're second, that doesn't mean we should take you seriously as title contenders. Right. Liverpool and Arsenal have serious pedigree, recent experience, and managers that have been there in the last few years. They know how to get it done. Chelsea are playing really, really well. They're surprising me. My hands are up. They're outperforming what I thought they would do this year. But this narrative that Chelsea are, you know, serious title contenders for me, I find quite bizarre. So if we're going to be pedantic, are they in the race? Okay, yeah, they are. Am I taking them seriously as potential Premier League winners? No, not for me, Clive.
And anyone else want to upgrade their thoughts?
Well, I don't understand what makes them any different in their position with an identical record to Arsenal, but with two goals more, with a much bigger squad, a squad that actually has been utilised very well. Maresco has done very well in utilising a squad in Europe and making them fresh. And again, you know, as many teams did in midweek, make some significant changes. I mean, if you're going to make changes, you can away at Southampton. And then Stevens adds to the equation because he likes Cucurella's hair. They have to be in with a shout. And obviously the most important moments will be against the most important teams in the league and whether they get those results that require to put the stamp on it that they are in with a shout. At the moment, you have to say they are, and whether they're in the race or not, they're above Man City, they're above Arsenal, even though it's by goal difference, and they deserve to be there. I'm not a Chelsea fan, and stated on another pod how much I wasn't interested in Chelsea this season because of their handling of Fernandes. but they're making sure that you cannot deny that they're a quality side with a quality squad that are making waves at the moment and are deservedly in with a shout.
Another pod. You weren't on the ramble, were you? Because, you know, don't want to talk about that. Not our fault. It's our listeners' fault. Barry, we have talked about the disadvantages of having long hair, Boutfass, Fellaini, etc. But there's no way Jack Stevens can do that if Cucurella has a short back and sides. It sort of reminded me of Dougal in Father Ted. I think he's on a plane. There's a big red button and a sign that says, do not press this button. And he's just staring at it. You know, you could just see Jack Stevens going, oh, and then he just couldn't help himself.
Yeah, it was a really dumb thing for him to do. Jack Stevens has already been sent off this season for, I think it was a bad foul on tackle on Garnacho in a game against Manchester United. And such was the emphaticness of his protests at this completely reasonable decision, as I recall, that he got an additional two games on top of his three. So he's already done a five-match ban, and now he'll get four for this. So that's nine games he's missed, and he's Southampton's captain, I think. That's really just really poor discipline bordering on outright stupidity. But anyway, he's done it now, so, and any slim chance Southampton had of rescuing anything from that game, they were 3-1 down when he decided to have a little tug at Cucurella's hair. And, like, they weren't even contesting a ball or anything at the time. He was just, you know, something to do. There's, like you say, do not pull my hair. Oh, I can't resist.
I just want to briefly add on this hair thing as well, because I think for a lot of people it is quite... It's not a big deal, but maybe I'm sensitive to this because I've got particularly long hair. I've got dreadlocks. I don't think we should be dismissing pulling somebody's hair, because for a lot of people, their hair is a very personal part of their body. And I think that it's just twice has happened now. And I really feel like you wouldn't go around cupping somebody's nether regions and we would be giggling about it. Maybe some people would. For some people, not only does it hurt to have your hair pulled, but it's actually really disrespectful. It's really, really out of order. And I really think something needs to be done now about this sort of thing happening. I think somebody was saying it constitutes violent conduct. I'm not quite sure if I put it in that bracket, but it's something that I think has been made light of that I don't think is a light-hearted thing. Am I making sense with that?
You are. I know what you mean, but at the same time, pulling someone's hair is just, it's so playground, right? It's so like what you did to your sister when you were seven. And I think that's why it's sort of, inverted commas, funny. I take your point totally. And at the same time, do watch it and think, you know, I haven't pulled anyone's hair since my sister Susie was six. Do you know what I mean? And she was can-canning at me or something, you know, and I was like, get away from me. Just a question on Southampton, Troy, and playing out, right? Obviously, they like to play out, and obviously people play out. But we saw this with Joe Lumley. We saw it with Verbruggen for Brighton. We saw it with Forster for Spurs, the goal that was disallowed for offside. That pass, which is straight to a centre midfielder who is sprinting towards you, right? It is in something like that. It's such a hard pass to pull off. And then even if you do, like, the midfielder's got to be so good to take it and turn or go nowhere. It's like, fine, play out. That's fine. But that pass seems total madness.
I agree with you, Max. I'm interested in the teams that don't mix up how they do play out from the back. We saw quite a number of mistakes, as you've highlighted there, this week alone, you know, from clubs that are persisting in it. But let's get this straight. Southampton have won one game this season. They're following in the line of Vincent Kompany, who wanted to consistently play out with Burnley and the mistakes that are being made there. At what stage do you realise that the players around you are not good enough to do it? And it has to be highlighted. A lot of the players are not even sprinting towards the goalkeeper or the centre-back. They're ambling without even recognising that they are going to... Teams have worked it out, so they're going to be pressed, they're going to be squeezed high. And like you've just said there, you've got to have some ability to pop it off first time or to keep control of the ball and spin round it. And if I'm a manager at that level, whilst that is my philosophy, you have to be able to change it up when you realise your team is not able to consistently play the way that you want to play. And that's why Southampton are bottom, and that's why some other teams are conceding lots of goals, just silly goals, really, because this fascination in doing it. And everyone blames Pep or blames Arsene Wenger or blames other managers, but they had the quality of player, but also the foresight to go, do you know what? We've been pressed very high by four centre forwards who are not going to let us play out. So let's miss them all out and drop something into one of our centre forwards or a wide player. It should be as simple as that.
Mm, I feel, Troy, that while we were talking about Southampton there, you were really talking about Spurs. But we and I hear you. Preach, brother. Preach. We'll get to that. Arsenal beat Man United 2-0. They've scored 22 goals from corners since the start of last season. Miles more than any other Premier League side. What new do we have to say, Barry? Again, I'm sorry about this, but
I think it was Dimitar Berbatov after this game compared them to Stoke, Rory Delap era, Pulis era Stoke, when they terrorised everyone with long throws. And I think a lot of Arsenal fans, because they all hate Stoke, obviously, took grave exception to being likened to these uncouth ruffians from the Britannia Stadium. But I could totally see his point, because it's at the point now where if Arsenal get a corner, other teams are visibly terrified and they're totally preoccupied with Arsenal having corners, not giving away corners. And they're panicking and then they're giving away cheap corners. And in Bukayo Saka and Declan Rice, Arsenal have two brilliant corner takers. Saka's tend to go long, Rice's to the near post, and then they have all the jiggery pokery going on in the penalty area, legal, much of it grey area, some of it downright illegal, but there's so much going on, as we said. It's hard for the officials to keep tabs on everything. And in this game, they scored from two corners, and they could have scored from four more, I think. Rice almost scored direct from a corner. Partey missed a glorious opportunity very early. I think it was their first corner. Martinelli fired over from a corner that wasn't cleared properly. It's a lethal weapon and a great one to have in your armoury.
The Spanish commentary started doing the Jaws theme when they got a corner. It was absolutely brilliant. It started going dun 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 dun. Why doesn't everyone do it, Jordan? Is it just the delivery? And the delivery, as Baz says, is so good.
It's almost perfection, and you know that phrase undefendable. And I think with the movement they've got, it's very difficult to stop. And look, it will end at some point. Teams will work it out. It won't last forever. But I was there at the Emirates on, when was it, Wednesday, and as you say, it got to the point where the fans start doing the because they know, and you can see the United fans in the corner genuinely looking on like, this is going to be a goal. They're almost expecting it to be a goal. Just going back to Barry's point, I don't think it's so much that Arsenal fans are taking issue with being compared to Stoke, which there's some issue with that. I think it's more this really, and it can only be banter, this banter narrative that somehow corner kicks don't count. If you score from a corner, It doesn't count. It's like it's still a goal. And look, it's a weapon. We didn't even have our biggest weapon scoring from corners there, Gabriel. So it's something that, you know, they've worked on very, very well, and it's proving to be very, very successful. I just want to say, I think it was a really good game from Arsenal in the second half. The first half was awful. They allowed themselves to be dragged down to United's tempo and pace in that there was zero. Second half, they upped it a little bit, and they should have scored a lot more than the two goals they did. Just a quick note, though, top trolling from Saliba with a knee slide after scoring from his backside, I thought was quite funny as well. But a quick note just on Manchester United, and this is anything particularly new I'm saying here, but it was just watching it live in front of you, you can really see how the Man United players, they don't know what to do. So the right back gets the ball, and then it's like, back to the keeper. Keeper gets the ball, back to Maguire. Maguire gets the ball, into Fernandes. Fernandes back to Maguire. They genuinely don't know what they're supposed to be doing. And I think that the job that Amorim's got after fitness, because they're not a very particularly fit team, is making them really clear identity of what it is you're meant to do, because it's all system players now, isn't it? It's all about systems, and that's how tactics work now in football, unfortunately. But it was really evident when they had that ball in the first half in particular. No one knew where they were meant to go, where they were meant to be. It was really stark when you see in front of you, when you watch it live, how they're just clueless as to what they're supposed to be doing.
Big lesson for me, for the Manchester United manager. Look, I know he's new in the post. I know he's trying to look at, there was commentary on the fact that he does rotate his side quite a lot. I watched the first half and I instantly regretted it. It was such a poor first half. But one, I didn't understand his lineup. You know, this is Arsenal away with a couple of players missing and a couple of players in very important positions. And I think the most important positions were the wide positions. So to drag Rashford and Aman out of that.
Do you know why, Troy? He's doing what your manager, Postecoglou, I think did last year. I think he's sacrificing the game short term to really experiment and the bigger picture. Look at his lineups in every single game. They've been different. And he's using five subs in every game.
Yeah,
what he's
yeah,
doing
yeah.
is he's saying, you know what? This year, I'm going to use this season to just see who's serious, who can I trust, who's fit, and who can work to my system. So if it means short-term pain...
I'll caveat that with what a statement it would have been for them to take away anything from the Emirates, whether it's a point, whether it's a... What a statement it would be.
What would that mean?
Well, it would mean quite a lot for the Manchester United fans, and I think it means quite a lot for the club.
I don't think it does.
I looked at the set pieces, and yeah, we can glorify. Those set pieces are put on a sixpence. But the lineup, the way Manchester United lined up, in front of all the Arsenal players that were going to rush in, unaware of what positions they were going to take up, again, showed a little bit of naivety to me. So there's a lot of work to do. I'll take your point, Jordan. I look at it totally different. I thought that would have been a statement victory if they could have had it. Well, you don't know. But to take out a couple of the players who I potentially would have thought would have caused Arsenal some damage, particularly with second-choice fullbacks, and obviously a second-choice centre-half or third-choice centre-half as well. I just thought they missed a trick there.
Just a note on Kath Phipps, Manchester United's long-term receptionist, yeah. Who's passed away at the age of 85. She was a childhood United fan who grew up in Greater Manchester, worked with the club for over 55 years in a variety of roles, became United's switchboard operator in 1968, just after they'd won the European Cup. So many former players, like total legends of Manchester United, sort of putting out really heartfelt, not just sort of tokenistic social media, but really heartfelt ones. And even at a club of that size, you know, like this is the biggest club in England, right? To that idea that it is, and you know, we talk about the FA Cup third round and people talk about the tea lady and the receptionist and all that. It's just a total sign that, you know, people make football clubs. And I just thought it was such an incredible example of that, of so many people have been through that door and have seen Kath Phipps, and that could be, you know, that will be, she is representative of so many people at so many football clubs, regardless of size. Jordan,
if you look at the Instagram page that they where they honoured her, go and look at the replies and look at the amount of ex-players, you know, journalists, media members that have all paid their respects. And I never met the lady.
Yeah, I met her a couple of times,
but it just shows how impactful she was. If you just look at all the people, past and present, who were showing their respect.
Yeah, send her love to her friends and family, of course. That'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Bournemouth's victory over Tottenham.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf dem Mobilgerät eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 € pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Uh, Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, we should congratulate the Football Ramble for taking our crown. Gopal got in touch to say, Max, your podcast is so, so good. And many people were in touch. Whose fault is this? What is this? Did you hold up 6-7 fingers to the crowd? What happened?
Well, I'll tell you something, Max. The Best Podcast Award, I think, was handed out last. So by that stage of the evening, I couldn't count fingers, let alone hold them up. You know, hearty congratulations to the lads from the Ramble. I know them, I wouldn't say well, but I know them, and they're all top lads. And I'm blaming our listeners for this. But we will come back stronger, Max.
Yeah, root and branch. That's what I'm saying. What we're doing now is we're just throwing anyone into the pod just to see what's working. This season doesn't matter anymore. Like Amarin, we just try any old fucker. Just see what's going on. Look at today, for goodness sake. Let's go to the vitality. Autumn says, I thought it was noble of Tottenham to sit out in solidarity with the Guardian writers. Look, Bournemouth have beaten Man City, Arsenal and Spurs at home. Although I think, Troy, it's generous to put Spurs in that group of big home wins. I could see this coming a mile off, and with apologies to Bournemouth fans, you know, I think the story is Tottenham and the pressure that Ange is under. He went to sort of confront is probably too strong a word, talk to a fan afterwards. And this is really interesting with Bournemouth and Tottenham, I think, Troy, is that both of those teams like to press high, they like to play the ball out, but there's one team that is not afraid to mix it, right? To go long, to say, okay, and there's one team that just doggedly refused to do anything different. And it was just, even though Tottenham started this game quite well, it was so obvious as soon as Bournemouth took the lead, it was done.
I disagree slightly there with the fact that Tottenham refused to do anything different. Dragosin, I think his first, I don't know, 10 touches of the ball was to launch it aimlessly down the pitch. And he continued that in the second half because he knew that he couldn't play in the middle. Now, whether Ange was upset with him or not, I'm not sure, but he launched some of the longest balls. They weren't passes, just straight down the pitch, aimlessly. Look, this Tottenham side, people have got a little bit too excited with the two wins against Man City. Way too excited with the two wins against Man City. Yes, the win away from home in the league was exceptional and they played well, but that's not the Spurs that we've been watching for most of the season. There's a little stat that came out last night that they've not gone two games unbeaten since September. The stat is loss, win, loss, win, loss, win, draw, lose. That's not good enough by anyone's status. We were led to believe that the second season from Ange would be something exceptional and they would win a trophy. They're still in the latter stages of the Carabao Cup, I understand that, but ultimately, if the league form doesn't improve, listen, if he was Nuno, Jose or Antonio, lose against Chelsea on Sunday and I think he's gone. But he's not. And he's being given a blight at the moment. But you can see from what happened last night and it happened before that the Spurs fans are getting very edgy. And in getting very edgy, calling out the manager at that stage, I don't want to use the language that was used because I saw one of the fans' footage, but he's now under pressure. And he doesn't look a happy guy anyway. So when he's on the sideline and he's watching his side play some pretty awful stuff yesterday, I think he's wondering where else he can be. So I don't get it. Listen, Bournemouth were amazing. Let's not take away from their performance last night, because how they never won 4-5 and maybe more, I will never know. Because they took Tottenham apart at will. But this Spurs side, they've got a lot of questions to answer. I don't think he trusts a lot of the team. People were waxing lyrical about Maddison's performance against Man City. I don't think he trusts Maddison to perform like that in 2, 3, 4 games on the spin. Son is now an ailing Son. He's not the same as what he was before, but he wears the captain armband, so he's almost obliged. All right, I know he got rested yesterday. He's had a few injuries. He's not hit the peaks that he has in previous seasons. And I just think that there's not a lot to be writing home about at the moment with this Tottenham squad.
And I always say, Baz, look, it's a sign of a good team to win when they're playing badly. But when Tottenham play badly, they don't win. But also, they can play well and not win as well. It's a terrible mix.
Well, it's textbook Tottenham, isn't it? And Ange is just the latest guy to go through the the meat grinder there. I think we all had a fair idea what would happen after they beat City. I thought Fulham would beat them. Tottenham got a draw and were very lucky to get a draw. And they've lost this game. They drew against Roma in the Europa League. I didn't see that, so I can't really comment on it. They will probably beat Chelsea at the weekend and then lose their next two against Rangers and Southampton, because that is what Tottenham do. And better men than Ange have tried and failed to fix it.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And it looks like he's going to be the latest guy to fail to fix it.
I mean, I think Tottenham fans think Chelsea could absolutely hammer them. You know, another centre-back out, or not even a centre-back. You know, they've just got Dragos in at centre-back.
Yeah. I mean, that is the caveat, or the... Yeah. You can say they're missing Vicario. Although Fraser Foster, who everyone was very worried about, has helped them keep the score down in two matches or three matches now. They're missing Mickey van de Ven, Christian Romero, Bentancur is suspended, obviously. So there are some mitigating factors.
Yeah. I think they would be mad to get rid of Ange Jordan, because I just don't... there is a project there. You know, they're in three cuts.
Who would replace him? I used to admire his absolute doggedness and refusal to change his ways or his team's ways, but it is become apparent that it is quite... It's just bordering on stupid now.
Just before Jordan comes in, Max, you said there's a project there. Can you kind of tell me what that project is?
No, I'm not here for details. There is, I agree. I think he should mix it up, but they are trying to play football. He's trying to build a squad. It takes a few windows. I think he started so well. That does give you some grace. They haven't been great after those first 10 games of the first season. But there is promise. You know, they have shown in games that there is promise. And the football, even yesterday...
But don't Spurs always show promise at times?
Not with Jose and Conte, I don't think. Okay, I've got a short memory. Jordan.
Yeah, no, I went to take the bins out just before we started recording, and my neighbour, she's a 76-year-old Irish lady, Eileen, she's a big Spurs fan. And she like really loves Spurs. And we were talking about the game and she was giving me her view. And I said to her, Eileen, do you think that you will see another Tottenham trophy win in your lifetime? And she replied to say, Jordan, I'm not convinced that you will see another trophy win in your lifetime. And it got me thinking, like, will we ever see Spurs win another trophy ever again? Because they just seem to be cursed. And Troy spoke really well earlier on about, you know, Russell Martin at Southampton and the kind of belligerence of playing out from the back and sticking with that. I think my question is to the people that employ these managers, they know what they're getting when they bring these guys in. So you can't then say to Ange, you're sacked because it's going wrong, because Daniel Levy would have known. Postecoglou's thought manager that I think would have been very upfront from the get-go. I want to play like this. I'm not changing. This is how it is. And you still employed him. So you kind of can't complain then when you get the City 4-0 and it works, but then you get the downside as well. So I think the focus should be more on why are you employing these managers that are coming with a philosophy or style of play. Then when it doesn't quite work out, you're blaming them and sacking them. That for me is the real question.
I think it's obvious that the last few managers at Tottenham have not been backed in the transfer market. You look at a lot of those sides that are above Spurs and they have certain amount of qualities that will win them games when they shouldn't win. You just mentioned that, Max, or, you know, they can go for a much bigger fee if they want to.
Yes, well, yeah, but Bournemouth, Villa, Forest, Fulham, Brighton don't. They're all above Tottenham, aren't they?
Well, I think Villa do. I think Bournemouth have got a manager who absolutely plays to the strength of his squad, and he proved it against Spurs last night. I think Spurs have got some very promising youngsters. I thought Archie Gray played well last night amongst the chaos. But I just think that they're missing some qualities that will be required to take Spurs, but also to implement Ange's kind of philosophy to help Spurs become a consistent team. They're not a consistent team at the moment. Listen, they may win the Carabao Cup. We don't know yet. And then we'll I think a lot of this and your neighbour Jordan and all that will be shocked.
Troy, We probably do know. I mean,
in fact, we definitely do know.
It's worth saying Tyler Adams was brilliant for Bournemouth because I was interested to see how they did without Lewis Cook. I thought that might be a big blow to them. He did come on, Lewis Cook. He wasn't 100%. But I thought he was great. I thought Ryan Christie was brilliant as well.
So was Hoyson, who scored the goal, the young man who scored after an early mistake. Yeah. So, yeah, there's some few good players last night that did well.
Just before, in case you've forgotten to do it, Max, Dean Huijsen, April 14, 2005, Amsterdam. Yeah. Is This the Way to Amarillo by Tony Christie, featuring Peter Kay?
Jesus. Oh, God help us all. We are so old. Man City 3, Forest 0, regulation win for Man City. Barry, nice to see Kevin De Bruyne out there being good.
Well, was it a regulation win, Max? Were you being facetious? Because they haven't had many regulation wins.
That's a good point.
I thought they might lose this one. Kevin De Bruyne starts. They play really well. Well, who knew? He was superb. This was very much the Kevin De Bruyne show with a sousson of Jeremy Doku dust or a sprinkling of Jeremy Doku dust. Hugely impressive win for City that I think quite a few people thought they might slip up again after their bad run. Forest weren't terrible, but City were miles ahead of them. And yeah, it just very much was the Kevin De Bruyne show, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I guess if Chris Wood scores that goal at 1-0, and you expect him to, given his form, that could have, you know, given how vulnerable they are, that could have changed things. Jordan, you were saying that, you know, Chelsea are you versus Carl Lewis and Usain Bolt. What are Man City in this? What are they? Atto Bolden, Dennis Mitchell. Who are they in this? Linford Christie in this 100 meter
sprint?
Very
much Ben Johnson, I think.
Oh, wow.
Can I separate myself from those comments? Just to know that there was a Barry's thought.
Of course you can. Just in case Lord Panic is listening. Yeah, City deny all the charges. Do carry on, Jordan.
No, I mean, if anything, they're probably the Usain Bolt in that a fading force, but one that you're still not quite convinced you could probably be. Obviously, much has been made of Rodri's absence in that squad. I think people are forgetting how good De Bruyne is. Yeah. And I think his absence is just as crucial to Rodri's. They do different things, but it's an aging Kevin De Bruyne. He's had some difficulties with injuries in recent years. But when he's on form, I still feel he's the best player at what he does in probably world football. And it was good to see him kind of flexing again yesterday. I think City have just got to kind of do what Arsenal had to do 3 weeks ago. Just win the next game and then just kind of see where they are. Because although I'm not taking Chelsea seriously, the title talk, you know, if this continues, City could find themselves, if they don't get their form back, in a fight for top four.
Mm. Well, on Usain Bolt, and I know I've said it before, but when he had a tryout for, I think it was Central Coast Mariners in the A-League, some commentator saying he had a first touch like a trampoline. It's just one of my favourite sayings. Wow. It just says everything, doesn't it? Nice to see Jack Grealish and Jota Silva sort of tackling each other because they do look like brothers, perhaps with different dads. I'm not sure. There is a sort of real likeness about the two of them, isn't there?
Jack Grealish had a quite central role in this game. I thought he did well.
That's a good point.
He contributed a lot to the victory. So maybe that's something Pep might do more of in the future.
Yeah. And him with Doku, because, you know, Doku's so, like, fun, isn't he? Out on the left-hand side. You know, Grealish is a different, more technical player, I think. Or a slower player, you know. But I love watching Doku. He's got such talent, hasn't he? Let's go to Goodison. Everton 4, Wolves 0. I want to congratulate Everton, Troy, but if you concede 4 goals to Everton, you have to ask what's going on. That's like a season of goals at Goodison Park.
Yeah, it is very much so. I actually thought the pressure was on both managers coming into this game. I think Sean Dyche is a little bit safer. And what Dyche does incredibly well is he always pulls a result out when people are questioning whether he still should be in a job. And that was a massive result. As for Gary O'Neill, listen, I think they go to West Ham on Saturday or Sunday, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, both, again, it's a situation where both managers are under extreme pressure, but the goals that Wolves are conceding, and to go to a one goal every other game, Everton, and concede four, even though two of them were obviously have been put down as Craig Dawson own goals, kind of shows you where that club is at the moment. It seemed a couple of weeks ago like they were having an upturn as well, weren't they? Cunha was scoring goals and Larsson, and they looked like they'd got over their bad rut, but very quickly they've gone straight back into it. And I think it could be, it's alarm bells for him if they lose away at West Ham. Defensively all over the place, a lot of set pieces. Wolves generally have been good with big centre-halves previously, but I don't know, Everton got in on them and created some very good chances. Ashley Young's goal, there was questions about the wall there, how did that go in? But listen, I think Goodison Park would have been a very good place to be to watch goals all of a sudden. But yeah, the signs are there for Gary O'Neill and they're not good.
You wonder, Jordan, if Craig Dawson will be one of the top scorers at Goodison this season as well, with two own goals in a game. Like, on the Wout Faas scale, he's nowhere near it, is he? Because they were both slightly unfortunate. Calvert-Lewin would have... He's just taken two goals off Calvert-Lewin, really, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. I mean, yeah. I don't know how you... Do you just put yourself in the wrong position at the wrong time? And are you trying to slash at things and you're unlucky? I don't know how you kind of get that many own goals. But yeah, he was unlucky in this one for sure.
What do we think for Gary O'Neill's future? So imagine, Baz, that West Ham game. Like, everyone will be sacked after that game.
Yeah, I mean, Wolves are diabolical in this game. Conceded, was it three or four from set pieces? There was one disallowed that came from a Tarkowski header from a McNeil free kick. So, yeah, they can't handle balls into the box. I mean, they did sell... They do have a habit of selling centre-backs and not replacing them adequately. The only thing I would say, while West Ham lost against Leicester, I don't know how they lost because there's so many chances. And, you know, when your luck's out... And Gary O'Neill spoke after this game with the demeanour of a man who fully expects to be sacked and might actually welcome having Christmas off.
Ashley Young, now the fourth oldest scorer in Premier League history, the oldest to score from a direct free kick. Does anybody, trivia time, want to guess one of the three older than him to score in the Premier League?
Giggs, Ronaldo.
No.
Thiago Silva.
Thiago Silva, correct. 1 point for Jordan.
He's won a goalkeeper.
No.
What team?
Hull City is one of them.
Oh, Windass.
Correct. Dean Windass, 2 points. And the oldest scored for, I think, for West Ham against Portsmouth, but could have been for Portsmouth against West Ham.
Teddy Sheringham.
Correct. There you are. So well done, Ashley Young. You mentioned Leicester West Ham. Barry, Leicester 3, West Ham 1. Great result for Ruud van Nistelrooy. The first manager in English top flight history to beat a team twice and then manage them later that season. But yeah, you think West Ham actually deserve to get something from this game, Baz?
I do, yeah. I think they had more chances than Leicester. Leicester were just more clinical. West Ham's XG was 3.10 compared to Leicester's 1.67. And Ruud van Nistelrooy sort of acknowledged it afterwards. He said, look, this is a great result. We really need it. But there is a lot to do here because I think he kind of acknowledged they got away with this one. But Julian Lopetegui just looked absolutely ashen-faced afterwards because I thought West Ham played reasonably well and had a lot of chances and just couldn't put them away.
It's amazing, isn't it, how sad manager... I mean, he's on, what is he on, 3, 4, 5 million a year? I don't know. Like, I think if I was paid that, even though I was having an absolutely rotten time and being yelled at, I'd probably just be all right.
Surely the more you're paid, the more you're going to take it to heart because you feel you should be doing better and are letting everyone down.
Yeah, but you'd also think, if I really let them down, I'll just get a giant payoff. I mean, life isn't all about money.
No, it isn't.
It's a ludicrous... I mean, football management is just such a totally ludicrous profession. And I suppose, you know, the point is that these people have professional pride. I'm not saying I don't. And so, you know, that's why people like Lampard and Rooney, like we talked on the EFL pod, you know, want to keep doing it, even if they just have a rotten time and they have to sort of move around the country to random places. Not that Plymouth and Coventry are random places. Tying myself in knots here. Anyway, that's, I bet they're not doing
they
that
are
on a
random
ramble.
Places.
Mm, yeah. You're right. They are random
and
places.
I would argue Plymouth is more random than most places. off down there.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. We'll round up the rest of the Premier League in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Fulham 3, Brighton 1. Win takes Fulham 6th. Had two late goals to win it. But Jordan, Marco Silva quietly doing a brilliant job. I think quite interesting in this season that there is this big clump of teams that can beat each other. I mean, there's no way of knowing which way this game would have gone.
No, and I'm not sure if it's even quiet anymore. This is the second season now where Fulham have really kind of asserted themselves as, you know, at worst, a top of the bottom half table type team, if not pushing and knocking on the door for a European spot. They play some good football. I mean, Fulham are that kind of an inoffensive team, right? So no one dislikes Fulham. And, you know, I wouldn't go as far as saying they're your second team sort of team, but they're very inoffensive. And the football they play is nice. It's a nice day out down there at the Cottage. And he's got some really good players down there doing some really good things. I'm not sure if they will be able to sustain this to get a European position. But going from a team that were perennial, you know, a yo-yo club between the divisions to now a team that is, I think, an established Premier League side that can knock on the door for European football, I think is a testament to the work that he's doing there. And you never ever hear him linked with other jobs. You never, when other jobs come up, you never really hear Marco Silva is, you know, someone that they might try and poach, which I find quite interesting as well. But this was a good game. Iwobi down there's, I think, found his level, and I mean that with all due respect, as an Arsenal fan, former Arsenal player, he is. We've got them on the weekend, so he's really becoming the man in that team. So it's good to see. It's good to see.
Mm, it's good to you to patronise Alex Iwobi.
A little bit, I know. I said it and I was like, oh yeah, this is bad.
Cliche bingo for any Fulham fan going, yeah, inoffensive, nice day out, lovely family.
But am I lying? Am I lying?
No.
Only in the summer, Jordan.
It should probably be pointed out that it wasn't a nice day at the Cottage because it was pissing rain.
You know what I mean? Generally down there, it's not so bad. You know what I mean?
Actually, the goal of the game was Brighton's. The touch from João Pedro trying to set up Baleba and the finish. But I think Pedro is a star.
No, I like him. I like him a lot. They've missed him, obviously, a lot this season. But then they've had Dadin Welbeck scoring goals and, you know, keeping them up there. He was missing, obviously, the other night. And I thought it was a decent game. I thought Brighton were in it for long periods. But then, as Jordan says, Alex Iwobi again pops up with an equally as good goal, and you know they're fifth and sixth in the league. There's nothing to sniff at. The thing is whether they can maintain it, like you say. But you know they're fifth and sixth in the league, and they are both playing decent football, enjoyable football, football that you know if you're watching a game that maybe has no significance to you, you will enjoy. And so long may it continue. I think both managers have done well. Just on the Fulham manager, he was linked, you say that, Jordan, and he was linked with a big move to Saudi a couple of years
ago. Right.
Yeah,
right.
And I think he kind of squeezed Fulham quite a bit in, you know, with the threat that he could leave. But he signed a new deal. He looks happy enough and he's creating a very good and exciting football team.
Aston Villa got a much needed win, Baz, over Brentford 3-1.
Yeah, look, when you're trying to get out of a slump, Brentford at home is just the tonic, isn't it? They have this absolutely dismal away record. It's inexplicable, really, at this stage, how bad they are away from home compared to how good they are at home. I know there's all this, you know, travel, unfamiliar surroundings, a hostile crowd, blah, blah, blah. But Premier League crowds aren't that hostile. You're still playing on a rectangular grass. It cannot be that difficult to get a few decent results on the road. Villa had been struggling. They won this one pretty convincingly and, you know, scored three goals. Flecken had to make a series of excellent saves to keep the score down for Brentford. Brentford at home against Newcastle on Saturday, in-form Newcastle, or in-form-ish. They'll probably win that one, 'cause, and it'll be like 7-5.
Was it a pen? Am I the only person that thinks that it wasn't quite convinced it was a penalty?
I mean, Ethan Pinnock can do no wrong on this podcast, of course. So
I thought it was, yeah.
He's miskicked it, and I'm not sure that he was fouled to miskick it, Dolly Watkins.
Well, I think Pinnock kind of gave him that little tug on the shoulder as well. Look, I will defend Ethan Pinnock to the hilt, but I think he was probably fair enough here.
Morgan Rogers' finish was brilliant as well. Finally, Crystal Palace won 1-0 at Ipswich. Just on the goal, Troy, Mateta's, I mean, that is brilliant centre-forward play. Touch, strength, skill. The finish is so delicate. It's like this is what you want. The chance, it's not really a chance when he gets the ball. Yeah. And it's brilliant.
Anyone that would have seen Mateta when he first came to England and was trying to score goals for Crystal Palace, I think Palace were looking to get rid of him. He'd send him out on loan under Roy Hodgson. And, you know, it just wasn't happening for him. He even scored in the game against Brighton away from home. Unfortunately, with no fans, with a lovely back flick. But it just didn't seem to work for him. And then comes the back end of last season. And he has been on fire. The Olympics has taken a little bit out of him, but when he's on it, he's on it. And yeah, it was an absolutely brilliant goal. A nice way to decide the game. He's a young man. You know, he's tall, he's gangly, he's everything that everyone says that a professional footballer shouldn't be. But he hits them well. He has great feet. So he dances around the pitch a lot of the times. So he has great feet. And he's going to be one of the reasons why Palace are competitive and try and haul themselves up with, obviously, Eze now that he's fit. Because he was brilliant on the night as well and created some really good chances. So long may it continue. But yeah, a top, top class finish from Mateta there.
In the UK, all these games are on Amazon. I'm not sure who the commentator was for Ipswich Crystal Palace, but before the game he said, Palace haven't lost a top flight game against Ipswich in 43 years. I thought, oh, that's impressive. Then I checked, not so impressive. When you discovered top flight games played between Ipswich and Palace in the past 43 years, 2. Palace won one, drawn one, and now they've won another one. So well done, Palace.
Ipswich Town captain Sam Morsi chose not to wear the rainbow armband due to his religious beliefs. He's a practicing Muslim. Ipswich Town said, we proudly support the Premier League's Rainbow Laces campaign, stand with the LGBTQ+ community in promoting equality and acceptance. At the same time, we respect the decision of our captain, Sam Morsi, who's chosen not to wear the rainbow captain's armband due to his religious beliefs. Crystal Palace's Mark Gay wore the armband and wrote, I love Jesus on it. The FA chose not to take action against him, but reminded the club and the player that religious messaging on their kit is banned. Manchester United shelved plans to wear a pride-themed rainbow jacket supporting the LGBTQ+ community after their defender, Nusayir Mazraoui, said he would not be able to wear the jacket on the grounds of his Muslim faith. That's according to The Athletic. Their report said some United players were unhappy with the decision. Troy, how do we navigate inclusivity when inclusivity for some people is necessarily exclusive for others? If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. I never like when two marginalised groups are pitted together and then there's this fallout. Listen, people much more in the know than me, Hugo Schecter, who used to be it was at Southampton, was at West Ham as a player care officer and as a gay man, wrote a stunning piece on LinkedIn, if you wanted to check that out, and then acknowledged Liz Ward, who educates in this space, and provided some common sense. And that's probably the best thing to say, so provided some common sense in this space, while there were others who were almost inciting a pylon. And no matter what it is, I don't agree with that. And look, this is not the first season that Sam Morsi's not wore the armband. You know, he's been captain of Ipswich for a little while now, and he didn't wear it last season, but there's no uproar because the championship is not big enough to talk about it. So the fact that there's uproar now is kind of like saying, well, why didn't you speak about it from the very off, you know? He's made his feelings clear. You know, we've just finished Islamophobia Awareness Month only a couple of days ago, and now people want to have a go at Muslims for believing in their faith and for practicing their faith and not allowing the game to impress on them that they should be wearing the armband, you know? And Look, I get it. I understand it. There is a place for everything and everybody in this game. But ultimately, we're also trying to talk about respect. And if we need to respect people's religion and people's belief, then we have to do that, not create a pylon that then enables people who really have no authority to have their say in this space. And people can say that about me as well, but I'm fortunate enough to know a couple of players that you've mentioned there. I'm also fortunate enough to know several members of the LGBT community and worked with them. So I get it from both angles, but there has to be the level of respect for anybody. You know, it's a difficult game in England to show your qualities around your faith, your religion, your background. It's difficult because they're, you know, it's a tribal industry here, but we shouldn't be piling on each other. That's probably what I would want to say. We shouldn't be piling on each other because it doesn't create a very good space.
Chris Poweros, friend of the pod and from the Spurs LGBTQ plus group, actually put a brilliant, the Proud Lilywhites put a brilliant post on Instagram. And part of it said this: look, there is lots of incredible work going on in various football clubs, particularly around fan inclusion. LGBTQ plus and fan groups are a testament to the ensuring sense of community, visibility and belonging. Handing over an armband without context is like giving someone a user manual written in a language they don't speak. It isn't going to land. It's not enough to say, here's an armband, wear it. Clubs and governing bodies need to step up with ongoing education that brings players into the conversation. It's not about shaming anyone into compliance. It's about building understanding so players can lead with purpose. If they choose not to wear it, they should be able to talk about it constructively. Let's remember LGBTQ plus rights and faith belief are not necessarily in conflict. There are plenty of LGBTQ plus Christians, Muslims, Sikhs, etc. And all of this is about human rights, which are universal and inalienable. And the world currently feels more volatile than ever. LGBTQ plus communities are having their rights rolled back all over the place. This might seem like an inconsequential spat in English football. It can have a global impact. Players need time and space to explore these ideas, to ask questions, to really grasp the bigger picture. That's how we build real change, not with a single match day, but through a culture of learning and engagement. And I thought that articulated better than I could. Anyway, I don't know, Jordan, Barry, if you have anything you want to add on this?
Well, the only thing I'd say is, look, I don't know any of the three players involved. I've never met them. They may very well not have any prejudices against gay people, but the look, the optics aren't good, and the impression I get is that these are personal prejudices hidden behind, oh, these are my religious beliefs.
I disagree totally, Barry, with that. I mean, look, ultimately, sorry to cut across you there, we all have a prejudice in us somewhere along the line. We have to highlight it and we have to understand, but also the players have to have a voice. And I think Chris is right. What you've read out there, Max, is that a lot of the times the players are told to wear something without proper understanding of what it's going to do or proper understanding of the player that's on the receiving end. I remember when Gary Neville said this to me, you know, oh, we were given a kick it out t-shirt and we were just told to wear it, you know, and we didn't know what we were wearing, but they still went out there and wore it. But I said to Gary, you know, there comes a time when a player's voice has to be elevated in this space, and we have to have the open and honest conversations. Education is a massive thing in this space. It won't change the narrative here. It won't change the fact that the players won't wear the armband, but it will at least provide some kind of understanding from their point of view and vice versa. And for me, that is the most important thing in this whole conversation. Yeah.
But there is always this conflict that there are, you know, there are so many countries, you know, strict Christian, strict Muslim countries where homosexuality is illegal, right? This conflict between a respecting of who someone is because, you know, you don't choose to be gay and religion, that is a conflict that is really actually incredibly complex. I mean, too complex for me to come up with an answer, I guess.
Yeah, it's incredibly complex, but we're a universal game. We're an international game. We embrace people into our sport. We, you know, the Premier League is probably has the biggest dynamic of people from right across the world. So it has to become complicated because they bring all their personal kind of, not agendas, but personal beliefs and personal feelings into our industry. But there's times when our industry doesn't want that just wants the footballer. And at the moment, there's people saying, well, we shouldn't bring politics into football, just play. But then there's also the fact that players and people working in the game will want to be identified for who they are. They want to be authentic. And if we don't allow that space, then why do we play the game, or why do we bring them into our game? So it's an incredible, difficult conversation where no one has the full and proper answers. But if we are open-minded and we begin the conversation with respect, then we may get to a point where actually everyone can understand people's points of views. And you're right, Chris has put it in good context. Like I said, Hugh has put it in good context, and Liz has as well.
I agree with Troy. And whenever I hear people saying we need to keep politics out of football, that feels like a very, very privileged position to take. Because for some people, their identity and their being is very, very political and prevents them from having the same experiences within football as other people do. I'd love to sit down with Mark Gahey and fully understand if he understands what the Rainbow latest campaign is about. The campaign is about whatever community you're from. If you're a woman, if you're black, if you're gay, whatever it is, football is a space for you. And I can disagree with your politics or your religion, but that's irrelevant. This is football, and this is a place for you. And I would love to think and love, I'd hope that he understands that. I thought it was very provocative what he does. Very disappointed that he wrote what he wrote. He's a proud Christian. That's fine. But I think what he did was very, very intentional, because he doesn't write that on the armband every single week. He wrote it on this particular armband. So I was a bit disappointed that he did what he did. But also I defend his rights, as I do with the Ipswich captain. If you don't want to wear the armband, you shouldn't be forced to either.
Listen, not everyone wanted to take the knee. You know, it becomes such a contentious thing that players...
I was against the knee.
including the black players, all stand up. And this is my identity. My identity is to stand proud. So there's arguments right across the board for all the kind of actions that are brought into the game. But I think the explainer and the starting the element of respect is the most important thing.
I just find it really hard to know, you know, at times we are, you know, critical of Saudi Arabia because of their stance on homosexuality. And then we, you know, I believe in religious tolerance, and I, you know, obviously an ally of the LGBTQ plus community. And, you know, I don't know where exactly I'm meant to sit in this place that's really hard to navigate, I guess. But briefly, changing tack, the FA Cup third round draw, Barry, is, I don't think they could have scripted a better one. It is amazing, like, how many brilliant games there are. You know, the class of 92 going to Man City, Liverpool, Accrington, Stanley. It's the milk advert. It's what Ian Rush drinks, you know.
Everton against Peterborough, where Ashley Young may come up against his son.
Unbelievable.
Which will be a real, really great story. What was the other one that leapt out at me?
There's Chelsea, Morecambe. So Morecambe are what? Bottom of the League Two. Tamworth, Spurs. It's great. And you've got, Bromley going to St James's Park. And then Arsenal, Man United. You've got one big game in it. I loved it.
Yeah. Look, I love the FA Cup third round. I love the FA Cup.
Yeah.
And I think there's... A lot of football fans of a certain age will always hold the FA Cup in extremely high regard, even if clubs don't take it as seriously as they might. But hopefully we'll get a few right good upsets and rollicking ties there on, what is it, the second weekend of January, whenever it is.
Yeah. Look, we don't have time to talk about the Club World Cup draw, but that'll come 15th of June to 13th of July. And then the Women's Euro, 2nd of July to the 27th of July. So this podcast, Barry, however non-award-winning it is, it will carry on forever and ever. There's nothing we can do, but look, that'll do for today. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Troy.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray and Max Rushton. 2 in 2 weeks, everyone. And our executive producer is Phil Maynard.
This is The Guardian.